This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today we look ahead to Groups G and H. Brazil, they're just pure World Cup. How good are they this time? We'll get the expert view from Rio. Not as straightforward a group as it might appear, with Mitrovic and the effervescent calves of Shaqiri. Tricky games in Serbia and Switzerland, while Cameroon are now spearheaded by Brentford's Brian and Bremo. Group H sees the rematch of Uruguay and Ghana. Luis Suarez is still there. Just imagine if he could punch one off the line again. Portugal will hope Cristiano Ronaldo's as up for this as he is for hammering Manchester United, while could Sun Heung-min be the masked hero for South Korea? Also today, in the last of our specials, we'll discuss women's rights in Qatar. All that, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nick Ames, just before he heads off to Doha. Welcome.
Hello, Max.
Jonathan Faduba, welcome.
Hello.
And Barry Glendenning back for just one of the previews. I mean, injury concerns. What's happened? You fell off the stage at the FSAs, did you?
I didn't fall off the stage. I tripped on my way down a ramp from the stage. I hastened to add, this was very early in the evening.
Right.
And it was not a drunken misadventure. It was just me being a clumsy fool.
Are the awards too heavy this time?
They are quite heavy, yeah. Right, okay. But yes, it was a good night. Another good night from the FSA, so thanks to them.
Johnny says, how does Barry feel about an honorary England supporter? That is, you have England in the sweepstake, don't you? You must be delighted.
Yeah, I think when I made my choice, there were 29 envelopes left, so needless to say, I got England.
Marvellous stuff. Well, look, let's start with Group G. Brazil, Serbia, Switzerland, Cameroon in this one. Before we hear from this panel, I spoke to South American football expert, Rio resident Tim Vickery, and this is what he had to say. Okay then, Tim. Brazil are ranked number one in the world. Their group seems okay. Is this their time?
You know, the group doesn't seem quite as okay as it maybe did a few months ago. You know, there's one or two nerves jangling as they look at the recent form of Serbia and Switzerland. And
sure,
they're bang in against European opposition. All the other South American teams get an Asian team first up, you know, and South America's record against Asia recently is very, very good indeed. Whereas Brazil are confronted with a bogeyman on every Brazil campaign since they last won in 2002 has ended as soon as they come up against a Western European side in the knockout stages. So there'll be a few nerves.
Why do you think that is?
We're getting deep here, aren't we? Because the Western European domination of club football is easy to explain. The Western European domination of national team football, I don't think, is as easy to explain. Sometimes over here, they'll say, oh, the Champions League and so on, the Premier League's only good because of the South American players. Well, hang on a minute. You take out all those South American players and it's still Europe that's winning the World Cup and providing most of the teams who are getting to the business end of the World Cup. In the golden era of Brazil, on 58 to 70, they had a lead, had a massive lead in terms of physical preparation. And they had a tactical lead as well. In 58, they introduced the back four. 70, it's a pioneer of modern 4-2-3-1. And the physical preparation was fantastic. The last two that they won, 94 and 2002, I don't think were particularly good World Cups, especially 2002. And they had balance, excellent physical preparation, and enough individual flair to get them over the line. Those things have not been good enough since. One of the worrying things for them is the way that Europe has discovered how to produce South American style players. And you look at that fateful quarterfinal 4 years ago in Russia, Belgium against Brazil. I think Brazil were a bit unlucky. I think that they deserved, it was the best game in the tournament. I think Brazil deserved the right to take that one into extra time and they would have had the momentum. But who's the most stereotypical South American player on the field? Eden Hazard, you know, low center of gravity, magnificently one-against-one situations. So Europe seems to be learning how to produce that kind of player. That's worrying. But I think this time round, I think both Brazil and Argentina will take some stopping. They're in it to win it, both of them.
Yeah. Look, the attacking talent of Brazil is immense, isn't it?
Yes, and it's come together just in the last year and a half. Since their last defeat, the final of the Copa America to Argentina in July of last year, everything has kind of come together. That generation of attacking talent, and Vinicius Jr. exploding as a world star. Rafinha, I've never seen anyone step into the Brazil side and make it look as easy as Rafinha. Richarlison, absolutely bang in form. Neymar, obviously, is totally focused, and this is the moment which will define his international career. He's got a sweet thing going with Lucas Paquetá. So individually, that they look good, and collectively, things have looked good as well. They haven't looked like conceding goals. There's been games out there where the goalkeeper can take a deck chair. And the attacking talent seems to be firing together. So there are very, very solid grounds for optimism.
I mean, in a deck chair or not, Alisson's obviously brilliant in goal, isn't he? And, you know, the strength and depth in that position as well. In front of him, Thiago Silva, is he still the absolute linchpin? I mean, we see how well he's playing in the Premier League, and it seems ridiculous for someone of his age.
The linchpin is Marquinhos. The coach will admit that he made a mistake dropping Marquinhos on the eve of the last World Cup. You know, you drop your quickest centre-back, you're asking for trouble, and Belgium punished them for that. So Marquinhos is the defensive linchpin. It's been a big call for them, who plays alongside him, because coming out of Russia, they didn't expect Thiago Silva to still be around, and they've been preparing Éder Militão. Now, that's gone even better than they expected. When the World Cup qualifiers that Marquinhos played with Militão, they didn't concede a single goal. Militão has a mistake in him, but his recovery speed is remarkable. So if you're going to play a high line, that's very, very useful. But they have a reverence for Thiago Silva. It's a coaching staff, like most Brazilian coaching staffs. They do all the numbers of the physical preparation stuff. And you say to them, well, hang on a minute, Thiago Silva plays in the middle of a three for Chelsea, and you're playing him in a four. And they come back with the stats that show that he covers more ground at greater speed for Chelsea than he does for Brazil. Now, I come back with that saying, well, doesn't that tell you something about the games that Brazil have had? When it really counts, he's going to be put under pressure, because when they lost the final of the Copa America, where did Argentina score the goal? The space between the left back and Thiago Silva. Now, part of that may be Thiago Silva's age, and also they can't press quite as well with Thiago Silva as with Éder Militão. And this is a Brazil side that likes to press. But also, you know, he spends his time in the middle of a three. He's got a left-sided centre-back outside him to deal with things there. Mm-hmm. So the movements are different in a back four. So if I'm playing Brazil, that's where I'm going to attack. They can switch sides. They can, if, you know, the Marquinhos and Thiago Silva can switch sides if they think they're particularly vulnerable down one flank, which I think gets back to your question that, you know, Marquinhos is the linchpin, and Thiago Silva, well, there's no doubt about it, he's going to be targeted, and it's going to be fascinating to see if he can justify the faith of Brazil's coaching staff.
Neymar occasionally isn't loved by everybody in his squad at club level. What's it like at Brazil?
I think he's very popular. I think he's very popular with his teammates. Underneath it all, I think there's probably quite a nice bloke there. That there's quite a nice lad. Obviously been spoilt by his surroundings. I mean, he's been hothoused since he was well before he was an adolescent even. But he seems to be extremely popular amongst his Brazil teammates.
And is it as simple as Casemiro sits and then everybody else in front of him goes?
Within the same idea of play, they've got three little tweaks, which they do with Lucas Paquetá. He's a joker in the pack, his versatility. And in those three tweaks, he plays three different positions, and he can play a fourth if you want him to. Fred is the second man in midfield, although in their most attacking lineup, that's Paquetá. Paquetá sits in for Fred, which does front load the team. There's a debate going on inside the Brazilian coaching staff whether they should start off like that or not. But it's not everyone going, because the role that they have for the fullbacks now is very different from the role that you might traditionally associate with Brazilian fullbacks. They don't want Cafu and Roberto Carlos bumming up and down the line. No, the line is, we don't want Liverpool fullbacks, we want Man City fullbacks.
Right. Okay.
So that's why they can still pick Daniel Alves, although he's going to be a reserve, I imagine. So the role of the fullbacks now is yes, to go as an element of surprise, but mainly to tuck in, make the extra man in midfield, hold the defensive line, and construct from deep. So that's a role that needs more brain power than lung power.
And finally, like, everybody obviously likes to, you know, plot the route to the final. When did Brazil meet Argentina? Is that the semi-final? It looks like that would happen.
Possibly, but they don't do that.
Are they not?
How do you
just
think,
beat everyone?
Yeah, well, no, how do you think you win five World Cups? You do it one at a time, you know. So you go into the tournament saying, we've got seven left, we've got six left, we've got five left, and then you count them down. There'll be none of that going on.
Right, I should teach the English a thing or two about how to do this. And just looking at the other South American teams, we've covered them in other previews. Do you feel it's Messi's time? Like, if you had to take a punt on Brazil or Argentina for this, who would you pick?
I would go with Brazil, because I fancy Brazil's defensive unit more than Argentina's. And Brazil have more top-class goalkeepers, and I would take Brazil's centre-backs over Argentina's centre-backs any day. Argentina's defensive stats are terrific. It's two goals in the last 14, although they're just about to play today. Although I'm not sure the Arab Emirates are gonna put too much of a dent in that. And it really doesn't matter if they do. The defence has improved out of all measure since Martinez of Villa and Romero of Tottenham came into the side together in June of last year. But you still think, under pressure, there have been times in Argentina that they've really been defending at full stretch. I find it hard to imagine Otamendi as at this stage of his career as a World Cup winning centre-back. Also, I think Argentina have suffered a real blow with the injury to Lo Celso, because he worked so well in that team, so well. And the heartbeat of the team is the midfield trio. You know, Paredes playing the first ball out with quality, De Paul giving thrust, and then Lo Celso slipping. It's got such a sweet thing going with Messi. And they're getting the ball to Messi close to the opposing goal, where he can either do something individually or combine with either Lautaro Martinez or Di Maria. So quite how they're going to replace Lo Celso, I don't know. There's some good players to come in, and you can switch the balance a number of ways, but that little partnership has gone, and I don't think they can bring that back. But I think they're very, very attractive to watch, and I think they can do some serious damage in this tournament. But if you're going to press me, Brazil or Argentina, I think defence is so important in winning titles, and I would back up Brazil's defence over Argentina's.
There'll be a bit more of Tim later when we discuss Uruguay. The panel haven't heard what Tim said, but, you know, it is Brazil. You are allowed views on Brazil. Jonathan, how do you rate them? What are you excited to see from them?
Well, I'm convinced that whatever Tim Vickery says is definitely worth taking seriously. So although I've not heard it, I 100% agree with pretty much all of it. But Brazil, I think, I'm sure Tim probably has mentioned this, but I think the focus will be on around Neymar and kind of like the legacy play for Neymar. Can he kind of spearhead them to a World Cup? I think his position in the pantheon of sort of Brazilian greats is probably on the line in this tournament to a certain extent. I think people have downtrodden him over the last 4 or 5 years. His choices, you know, choices on and off the field, obviously to go to PSG, and people may be feeling that he took an easy option to a certain extent. But I think with Brazil, he's like the main man, isn't he? And this is where he really takes on that burden and steps out of the shadow of Messi and has that chance to kind of, well, he can even overtake Pelé's goal record, I believe, in this tournament. So, yeah, I'm not sure if they're going to win it, but their team does look sort of quite functional rather than necessarily that place for flair, if you know what I mean. They're not like the Brazil of old, where it's like samba and dancing and everyone's, you know, looking class. I think Fred is in the team, for example, Casemiro, but I think they have that kind of weird blend of like European kind of like solidity, but at the same time, a little bit of flair that you might need. Antony's tricks and things like that. So I think they'll go far, but I'm not sure they'll win it.
I like the idea of Antony just spinning round and round in the World Cup final when he could play an easy pass to Neymar for a certain goal. It's interesting, actually, Nick, that, you know, when you talk about that this could be Neymar's legacy and it could be Messi's legacy, and you sort of sometimes forget that absolute ludicrous pressure that these individual humans appear to be under.
Yeah, what more do these people have to achieve on a football pitch to leave a legacy? And I remember being at the Argentina versus France quarterfinal in 2018 in Kazan. And obviously Argentina didn't really turn up, but they still lost 4-3 and ran it quite close at the end. And all the talk afterwards was, this is a tragedy for Messi. It must be the end for Messi. So obviously back 4 years later, and we hope very much it's not the end for Messi, but it does make a mockery, doesn't it, of the idea that a tournament, more than anything, is what you need a team for and is what you need to be tightly bound for, and not like France 2010 or something like that, just sort of tightly knit together, no major stars perhaps, and just all in it, hopefully getting through to the final. And I think it's human nature now, isn't it, to put a burden on the shoulders of superstars or individuals, and I think we're all going to be doing it over the next month. I don't think any of us is going to not fall into that trap. But yeah, it's quite reductive, and certainly in Messi's case, probably more than Neymar's case, it does belittle a bit what they've already done. But I will say that I would be delighted if we're sat here in 5 weeks' time, whatever, and Messi has won a World Cup, because it would shut everyone up, and also he would deserve it. So, you know.
Barry, would you be delighted if Neymar lifted the trophy?
I wouldn't say I'd be delighted for him personally. I'd be delighted for Brazil as a collective. I mean, every World Cup is important for Brazil, but I think this one is particularly important because Bolsonaro is gone. He's no longer the leader of Brazil, and he sort of hijacked the national team jersey, as you know, it became synonymous with him rather than, and what he stood for, his horrible policies, rather than the players who wear it so proudly. And so they need to try and reclaim that jersey for them. It's our jersey, it's not his. So I think that's kind of important. And I wonder, because there are quite a few Bolsonaro fans in that squad, Brazil squad, and quite a few who have been quite outspoken against him. And I wonder, will that be a problem in the politics, become a problem in the squad? Maybe it won't. I might be thinking about it far too much, but I do think this is a very important tournament for Brazil. They haven't won it for 20 years now. I think they could win it, quite possibly, and I wouldn't mind seeing them win it. They've only lost 5 out of 76 matches playing under Tite, but 2 of those matches, crucially, was the quarterfinal against Belgium in the last World Cup, and last year's Copa America final against Argentina, so that those both hurt. But I it's silly to say, of course, I'd have them among my favourites.
That's excellent insight. I said to Tim, it seems a straightforward group, but then actually he put me right, because Serbia, Jonathan, and Switzerland are both good teams. And, you know, on their day, they've got good players. They're, you know, they could both cause Brazil problems. I can't imagine Brazil not getting out of the group, but like, it's going to be difficult for either one of Serbia and Switzerland to get through, given that.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for them. I mean, Brazil kind of tend to find themselves playing Switzerland, don't they, somehow in World Cups. And also, I think in the last World Cup, did they play Serbia as well? So they've got history of playing both of them. In the last one, obviously, Coutinho was in the Brazil squad and it scored against Switzerland, and I think Paulinho scored against Serbia. So obviously, there's been a lot of change since then. I don't think Switzerland are kind of like as good as they maybe were in the past. So I think they'll be a bit more straightforward to get through. I think Brazil will qualify. I don't really see them having too many troubles. I find that this group kind of, I think it will go in a fairly straightforward way. I think Switzerland and Serbia is probably the game that might decide it. As much as I want Cameroon to sort of progress, I feel as though this might be a group where Brazil kind of top it fairly comfortably, and then it's the Switzerland-Serbia game that decides it.
Let's talk about Serbia a little bit, Nick. You know, Mitrovic, Vlahovic, that is, you know, Mitrovic is fun at a World Cup, I imagine.
Yeah, I think we often look at Serbia and we think mercurial a bit, don't we? We think of very talented, technical, maybe slightly temperamental sides, maybe not always the most disciplined. And these, I'm sure I'll be told by people, are maybe cliches, but I think they also have a strong basis in fact. But you look at the team they've got now, Pixi Stojkovic has come in and he's really instilled a discipline. He's got them working tactically very hard. He's got them pressing very well, I think, in a very coherent way, which we haven't really seen, I don't think, from Serbia teams before. And then we've got an attack and an attacking midfield that is, I mean, it's maybe not up there with like Brazil, but it's almost up there with anyone if everyone is fit. I mean, Dusan Vlahovic, one of the best strikers in Europe, has done fairly well, I would say, since stepping up to Juventus. I think he's had a bit of a knock in recent weeks, which is a bit of a concern, but he should be okay. Mitrovic, who I think most of us wonder whether he would ever make that leap between outstanding championship versus not quite up to it. Premier League has absolutely bridged it this season, been fantastic. Also got an injury, hasn't he, I think? So which I think might be a bit more serious. So they're hoping he's fit. And then if either of them can't make it, you've got Luka Jovic, who's showing signs of a revival after that slightly torrid move to Real Madrid, up there as well. And then you've got Milinkovic-Savic from Lazio, wonderful playmaker behind them. You've got Dusan Tadic, who seems still to get better and better at sort of whatever he is, at 34, 35. On the left, you've got Kostic, who's very, very, very speedy, skillful wing back or winger. You've got a lot of options there now for Serbia. And I think for the first time, you've got balance too. And I think, were they not in this group, you would be potentially tipping them for, you know, certainly quarterfinals. The issue, as I think Jonathan has just hinted at, is can they get past Switzerland? And they obviously played that climactic game, didn't they, in 2018 when they lost to the death and there was the Albanian Eagle controversy and all that. And we're going to see a bit of a repeat of that showdown. And basically, the winner between those two will go through. I actually think Switzerland... Sorry, you've asked me about Serbia.
No, carry on.
But I think it's going to be neck and neck because, well, I think Serbia have the slightly flashier names and are more potent on paper and probably man for man should take it. I think Switzerland have improved in recent years. I think it was very important for their confidence that they broke a bit of a glass ceiling, didn't they, of the Euros. I'm reporting at the game in Bucharest when they beat France and I remember sending a very like manic wired update to Football Weekly after that one and then they were quite unlucky against Spain in the semis and they've gone on and beaten Spain and Portugal since and I think they play at slightly higher tempo than they used to. They've got a midfielder now in Granit Xhaka who whatever people thought of him before, they need to forget it because he's playing the best football of his career and can maybe add something further forward that he maybe wasn't doing for his national team either before. Good forward in Embolo, we could go on. So I don't know. I actually think when I look at this group, this quartet, it's actually almost the most interesting in the tournament for me. And I wouldn't be stunned into silence if either one of Serbia and Switzerland took something off of Brazil. I think it's very, very tight, and I think it's a shame that one of those three teams, almost certainly Serbia and Switzerland, although we should come to Cameroon, is going to miss out.
Barry, you wonder with Granit Xhaka, you know, when he was playing well for Switzerland and terribly for Arsenal, Arsenal was getting furious. Do you think if he plays well for Arsenal, he therefore has to be shit for Switzerland? Is that how it works?
I don't think he will be. He's having the time of his life at the moment. As Nick said, and he, you know, he's clearly held in very high regard. I think it is brilliant that the Serbia-Switzerland game is the final, like they meet in their respective third games because of the political edge, and that one is... One of them will almost certainly go out on the back of that game, and it's going to be tasty, one would imagine.
Yeah. On to Cameroon. Jonathan. You know, they've got some good, you know, Zambo Anguissa is playing well for Napoli, isn't it? You know, and Bwemo at Brentford, who I confess I didn't know was playing for Cameroon until quite a short time ago.
I don't think he did either, Max. he only declared very recently, I believe.
As long as he knew before I did, I think it's probably important. But we seem to be writing them off completely here, Jonathan.
We are. It does seem like we're writing them off completely, and I think that's probably slightly unfair. But I do think they have a few issues sort of going into the tournament. They've not been in amazing form. I know it's kind of only just friendlies and things like that. But they struggled in obviously World Cup qualifiers, lost out to Algeria in the end, and then of course the recent friendlies they've kind of lost to Uzbekistan. Drew with Jamaica. So they're not in amazing form. I think the injury to Frank Zambo Anguissa, who you just mentioned there, is like a bit of an issue for them. Can he be fit? He's been in such good form for Napoli. And I think he really will be kind of like the midfield driving force if he can get himself 100% fit. Got up front, they've obviously got Choupo-Moting, who, you know, is 33 now, but still quite highly rated, even at Bayern. I think they're trying to extend his contract. I think he's done quite well, probably better than anyone would have thought there. And of course, Vincent Aboubakar is kind of like the man, the myth, the legend there for them. You know, he was a top scorer at the African Cup of Nations earlier in 2021, but it was 2022, you know what I mean? So earlier this year, basically. And he'll be the man that everyone looks for them to fire the goals. I just think that defensively, you know, Nick mentioned it there in terms of the firepower, for example, that Serbia have with Mitrovic and Vlah, you know, they've got some really good players. With Switzerland, I think the issue is kind of, can Brian Mbolo be relied upon for goals? But that for me, I think the problem with Cameroon is, can they keep those teams out? All of them have fairly decent firepower, obviously. Brazil. Serbia have two really excellent forwards, and then of course Switzerland on their day, you know, if Mbolo's firing, if they're on it, then they can score as well. So I just feel like Cameroon holding them out, especially maybe from set pieces, is potentially an issue for them.
I think that's absolutely spot on, Jonathan. I think one thing that Cameroon do that we don't necessarily see from a lot of the other African teams at the moment, a lot of whom set up in quite a low block, I think they do press high and they do push up with energy, and we saw that a lot in AFCON a few months ago. They were probably one of only sort of two or three teams that played a really high pressing game and tried to really seize an early initiative in games, and it often worked for them. Now, I don't necessarily think they've got the quality throughout the squad to make that stick this time, and I definitely think the defensive issues are there. But I do think we might see a bit more of a high-energy, high-impact game than we might have expected from them. And it might mean they at least ruffle a few feathers.
Baz?
Samuel Eto'o is the head of the Cameroonian Football Federation now, and he has predicted that they will reach the final and play Morocco in it. So that's worth bearing in mind. But like they haven't won a World Cup game in 20 years. They've only got out of the group once in 8 attempts. And it's probably a cliche, but they're renowned for having disharmony in the squad. And Joel Matip famously refuses to play for them. And he's a big loss, obviously. But he has said in the past that Cameroon squad, everyone seems to be more interested in what's in it for them individually than what can we do as a collective. And it will be interesting to see if that becomes a concern in this World Cup, as it invariably tends to do.
Yeah, I suppose in my mind, it's still 1990. So yeah. I sort of think, wow, they could cause a surprise. Roger Miller's only 60, he's only 71 or something, you know.
There is a connection because Rigobert Song is their manager. So, you know.
Who knows? Could be fun. All right, let's end part one. Part two, we'll do Group H, Portugal, Ghana, Uruguay and South Korea.
Erst 8 Stunden Arbeit, danach zum Training und jetzt sollst du noch was Richtiges kochen? Ja, das geht. Mit HelloFresh. Wähle einfach protein- und vitaminreiche Rezepte aus und erhalte genau die richtigen Zutaten in deiner HelloFresh-Box. So planst du deine Woche und Mahlzeiten easy und landest nicht immer nur bei Pizza und Pommes. Jetzt kannst du bis zu 100 sportliche Euro auf deine ersten 4 HelloFresh-Boxen sparen. mit dem Code FSSport100.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Group H then, Portugal, Ghana, Uruguay, the Korean Republic. Before we talk about Ghana versus Uruguay, which is going to be absolutely, well, it may be an anticlimax, but it's great that it's happening. Let's talk about Portugal. I guess we have to start, Barry, with Cristiano Ronaldo and just like the timing of his ridiculous interview. And now like everything that's happened, there was a clip I saw on social media of him sort of going up to João Cancelo and just sort of like holding his neck a bit, and then people just trying to work out if that's him being a great guy or being awful. And you're like, oh God, we've got so... Until Portugal go out, we've just got this on loop, haven't we?
Yes. There's a clip of him and Cancelo and the clip of him and Bruno Fernandes, who appeared to be quite dismissive of him when he turned up. I think this Portugal squad, the best possible thing that could happen to them is for Ronaldo to pull a hamstring before the first game and be out of the tournament, because they're such a talented squad of players. They've so much strength and depth, incredible generation of talents, and it's going to be all about him. You know, he probably shouldn't start, but he almost certainly will start every game. We've seen in the past him micromanaging the team. What was in the final, the Euros final in 2000? Yeah. Where he had to go off injured. So he basically took over in the dugout. It was, you know, gesticulating, and Fernando Santos, their manager, took a back seat. So much will depend on how Portugal get on, I suspect. Like, they made a mess of their qualifying group. They had to go through the qualifiers when they should probably have won the group. And it will be all about him, and that will probably cost them. And I think without him, they would be more than good enough to win the tournament.
What do you think, Jonathan?
I think that is the kind of issue that Portugal have, even ignoring Ronaldo. I think just generally the older members of the squad, they've got a really good crop of young players coming through. And it's kind of that mixture. Obviously, the manager Santos is kind of, he's got his loyalty maybe to his older stalwarts of, like, for example, you know, Euro 2016 and, you know, past tournaments, basically. So That's a concern, and I think obviously the kind of circus around Ronaldo is not going to help. You know, you can't imagine him really being dropped for any game, can you? And if he is, you can imagine I don't know if he could give an interview to Piers Morgan mid tournament, but like, you can imagine the kind of the tantrums if he doesn't, you know, maybe play X or Y game, basically. So he kind of is going to have to play if he's fit. So you know, as Barry said, maybe an injury might kind of make it easier for his minutes to be managed. It's a bit unfortunate because they do have like an amazing squad, and I, you know, Ronaldo wants to win at the end of the day. In fairness to him, he want nothing more than to win the World Cup, and if he has to miss a few games for it, maybe he'd accept that trade-off as long as he's playing in the final. But
would he? I don't know. Would he?
What? Exactly. That's
you
the
say
thing.
Portugal win the final, but you're only getting 10 minutes. You're getting that brought on an injury time just to wind down the clock. Do you take it, Cristiano?
Exactly. And you know, even if you look at, for example, someone like Bernardo Silva, he kind of plays out further wide for Portugal, whereas, you know, you'd argue he's an incredible sort of central midfielder. I know he can play in those wide spaces, but he's kind of almost shunted there to make way for others. So I like Portugal, but the recent form, you know, obviously losing to Spain in the Nations League, maybe a sort of a preemptor to kind of what might come in the latter stages of this tournament. One player that I think will maybe have a bit of a standout tournament potentially that I really like is Nuno Mendes, the left back. And I think he's someone who is someone to keep an eye on. There's not that many kind of, say, young talents really that you can hang your hat on and say they're going to have breakout tournaments. But I think Nuno Mendes, the PSG left back, 20 years old, I think he's already got 16 caps, but he's got a fantastic future. And I think he could emerge as one of the top kind of fullbacks after this tournament if he kind of gets the minutes and shows what he can do.
And Nick, like, Rafael Leão as well is such a talent.
Oh, absolutely fantastic talent. And I hope he gets unleashed a little bit at this tournament. He's one of those who you want to see get some good game time, isn't he? And just show what he can do. And I think a lot depends for Portugal on how they find that balance, I think, between, we've spoken about Ronaldo and his ego and what he brings or doesn't bring, but also defence and attack. They didn't necessarily have it at the last Euros. And I think it's going to be difficult for them in this tournament. I think they'll get through the group stage, but then you look at the second round and the two groups that we're talking about today are paired, aren't they? So they're probably either going to play Brazil or one of Serbia and Switzerland, both of whom have beaten them very recently and deserve to beat them. And I just, you can't write them off, not with the individuals we've been speaking about, but I'm nowhere near as convinced enough about them as a collective to say that we're going to be talking about them beyond the round of 16. But I am looking forward to seeing Leo. I hope he gets a lot of minutes on the pitch. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, only three Wolves players in the squad, so you're signing the wrong Portuguese players. What would be the conclusion from that? Let's talk Uruguay. First off, here's a couple of minutes of Tim Vickery. One of the, you know, the videos that's got me most excited about the World Cup actually is the Uruguay squad announcement. It was brilliant.
Sensational.
And you always forget how small a country that is population-wise, right? And people are always looking for dark horses. They do have some wonderful players.
They do. And remember that in two of the last three World Cups, statistically, they were South America's best side. It's an amazing statistic. You know, it's extraordinary. Yeah. They're capable of it this time. But that balance between the old guard and the new, they haven't achieved it yet. They've been looking for that balance for 4 years, you know, since they came away from Russia, and they haven't found the balance. And there are some huge decisions for the coach there, Diego Alonso, huge decisions for him to take about personnel and about the shape of the side, because the two things are linked. And you mentioned, you know, the generation of midfielders that they've got is terrific. And Valverde is now the most important player in the side. But I always think they're better with three in the central midfield. So you've got Vecino to sit, Bentancur to knit things together, and Valverde just to go and drop his bombs and use that lung power to pop up all over the place. If you play three in midfield in the centre, it's hard to play two up front unless you play a back three. Now, they could play a back three. That might work. That means you've got Diego Godin in restricted space. I mean, Godin's hardly had any football for months. He's creaking anyway. You know, he's just coming back.
Say.
Just coming back from knee injuries. He's had like half an hour of football in months. So doubts about him. You know, making Araujo of Barcelona absolutely vital, but he's had no football since the end of September when he broke down in the last FIFA date. They've been trying to rush him back. So these things cloud the issue. He has to work out who's fit before he can work out how to put the pieces together. And if he does go with three in central midfield and goes with a back four, then it's hard to play the 4-4-2, which has been their default system for a while. So if you're only going to pick one up front, well, you've got Luis Suarez, Darwin Nunez, even Edinson Cavani. You know, I mean, Cavani, both Nunez and Cavani can play wide if you want them to. But when Uruguay had a look at Nunez wide left in September, it didn't work very well. So there are huge decisions to take for Uruguay. And it's a group that leaves them very little margin for error. So, yes, Uruguay are really capable of doing some serious damage, but also they're well capable of going out in the first round.
And just finally, and I mean finally, Tim, there's obviously a lot of talk over here about off the pitch, about the World Cup being in Qatar, about human rights issues. And I know you're not in every part of South America, but like, is there that kind of conversation happening in Brazil or in Argentina? Not really.
I mean, it looks from my vantage point to be a European stroke Australian issue more than anything else. There's been very, very little talk about these issues. They do get mentioned and then it's move on. You know, but it's, you get the feeling that there are people in Europe who won't watch this World Cup in protest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't picked up any of that over here at all.
Tim, as always, lovely to talk to you. Enjoy the tournament. I know you'll be incredibly busy.
I will. And I'm dreaming of December the 19th when normal life can return. But if we can put the moral issues to one side, I think we'll have some fun until then.
Thank you, Tim. I think these are the dark horses, Barry.
So do I. Yeah. So do I, Max.
Oh, that's them screwed.
Yeah, they're this year's turkey. I quite fancy them, although, as Nick said, that if they get out of the group, could be tricky for them in the next round. But I don't think they would particularly fear Brazil. They've got a great blend of youth and experience. They've still got Edinson Cavani, Luis Suarez there. My worry for them would be that their defence is a bit old and tired and slow. And that, you know, they've still got Jimenez and Godin in the centre-backs. Brilliant players, but not the quickest. And that might be a problem for them. But I'm very much looking forward to seeing them play.
Actually, on the subject of Cavani, Sid Lowe has done a brilliant interview with him. Worth reading. And it's just, you know, he just sounds like he's this little bit when he says, I just want to, you know, I'm paraphrasing here. I might be completely wrong, but he just wants to get away from it all and lie under a tree in the woods and just sort of, and he's got that look where it just sort of makes me think of the Three Musketeers, you know, sort of Porthos or Aram or whoever, one of them just lying under a tree with a nice little hat on.
He said in the interview, when he retires, he wants to become a vet.
Yeah,
I can't see it myself, but you know,
mind you, might not be a vet.
Edison,
but, you know,
covered in shite out in the ranch doing TB testing. But good luck to him.
Well, I'd like the idea of just turning up, you know, with your cat, you know, because he's a bit poorly, and you open the door and there's Edison Cavani there ready to serve it. Better surprise I was is when I was watching. Was that movie with the Stephen Hawking movie where suddenly just Frank LaBeouf appears as a surgeon or something, and you go, what? That's a, you know, my wife is like, oh, that's just a French man being an actor, and I'm like, no, it's Frank LaBeouf. This is ridiculous. Jonathan, how do you see Uruguay's chances, and where are their strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah, obviously, a lot of the talk will be about Luis Suarez, especially for the Ghana game, and obviously Cavani we've mentioned there. I think two of the key players actually will be. Fede Valverde and Bentancur in the centre of midfield. And Valverde has a chance to stake his claim as one of the best midfielders in the world. You know, international tournaments are always where maybe players who don't maybe get that recognition for their club have the chance to sort of step out for their country and show everyone, actually, yeah, I'm a decent player. And although Fede Valverde is recognised as a top-class midfielder, you know, even Champions League final, I still think he sort of goes under the radar a little bit with Real Madrid, because obviously he's surrounded by other kind of bigger names to a certain extent. So I think he will be crucial to their chances there. And Bentancur as well. I think he's, although Spurs haven't been, you know, they've had a mixed season, Spurs, they're doing well, but not necessarily performing that well. Bentancur has sort of quietly been one of their best players, I think. And he's got a chance as well, I think, to sort of step out of that maybe shadow of, ironically, Son, who's in who he'll face, and obviously Harry Kane, and sort of show himself as a top player on the world stage. I agree with what Barry says about kind of the defence is a little bit ageing and there's a worry there, but I do think that in international football that can be mitigated a little bit. It's not as maybe fast paced at times, international football sometimes. So I think that they can be okay there. We've seen teams in previous tournaments where. Their defense, you know, the experience of the defenders can outweigh the kind of, you know, any lack of physicality that they lose as they go on. So I'm not massively concerned there, but I still think that, I mean, if they have to play, you know, if they have to rely on the defense, then it could be an issue going into the latter stages of the tournament. But I do like the squad. I think it's got a decent balance to it. I think they should qualify. But I think that South Korea game, ironically, South Korea is probably a kind of team that they might not like facing, actually, quite a technical side who can get forward really, really quickly and challenge that sort of the older head. So I think that is going to be a huge game, that South Korea Uruguay game. And then obviously the Ghana game is one for the ages, but I don't think it's we'll talk about them, I guess, now, but I don't think it's a vintage Ghana. And I think that's going to be motivation rather than necessarily quality that might see Ghana through in that one.
Let's talk about Ghana. You're right. They are the lowest ranked team in the tournament, actually, Nick. So like the sort of build up to Uruguay-Ghana maybe more than the actual game will be, right?
Yeah, well, and sadly, I don't think there's any Asamoah Gyan this time around, is there, to face off against Suarez. Yeah, they're coming underneath the radar a bit. I mean, they've got some excellent players. They've got good Premier League experience in central midfield. Obviously, they've Mohamed Kudus, who is at Ajax, has done very well this season. Come through the Right to Dream Academy, come through Nordsjælland in Denmark, as a few of their lads, I think, outstanding young players. So while they didn't qualify that convincingly, I can't say I've seen them put in many convincing performances when I've seen them recently in the last year or two. But I think they have got players who can hurt you, and I think it is going to be a motivation, that Uruguay game. It is. I was at that game in at Soccer City in 2010 as a fan, and I had the perfect seat in the lower tier, right on that goal line where Suarez did that. And I will just never forget the howl of absolute anguish around the place, which was obviously so pumped for Ghana. And I actually think Asamoah Gyan, when he took his penalty in the shootout of that game later, was one of the boldest things I've ever seen a footballer do. And it totally got washed away in the eventual outcome, sadly, because there was the nice Panenka penalty, wasn't there, for him? Oh, the old striker, Adver. But yeah, I mean, I don't think we're in for any such quite climactic heroics this time, but it's going to be a great occasion. And I think maybe Ghana can find the extra 5 to 10% for that. They will definitely get a lot of motivation from back home. But I definitely, from the bits and pieces I've seen of Ghana, have not been massively impressed. But the individual talent is there, I think.
Yeah, so at least a chance, hopefully, for Jonathan Wilson to complain about the IU brothers if he gets one of their games. Jim says, did anyone else have a Ramos to PSG moment when they saw Tarek Lamptey in the Ghana squad? Absolutely.
Well, that's Ghana, that's been their thing. They've got a lot of players to declare for them in recent times. I think Inaki Williams as well, and Dennis Odoi are recent call-ups. Nick can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. And Tarek Lamptey as well. And I noticed, I read somewhere, apparently Otto Addo, who's their manager, who was installed in the wake of their disastrous Cup of Nations performance when they finished bottom of the group and lost to Comoros, he has in his backroom team George Boateng and Chris Hughton.
Does he? Oh,
yes. Okay.
Chris Hughton, not very attacking manager, is
no.
he? But, you know. But absolutely lovely man, should be pointed out. Jeffrey Schlupp, not in the squad. His agent was not very happy about it, who went onto Snapchat to write, "Shit country, I hope you guys get knocked out. Fuck Ghana. Fuck the GFA. Ghanaians are disgraceful. Sick emoji. Don't ever call my phone again. Bunch of people, imbecile from the president all the way to the coach. Fuck you." So that's a slightly unmeasured approach.
So we're seeing for the AFCON qualifiers then.
Okay. Absolutely, yeah. Yes, Jeffrey Schlupp going, "I'm not sure if that's good for my long-term prospects, actually."
The thing with Ghana, I think, and I do not know if this is the case this time around, so I'm not implying it, but I think historically there's definitely been a bit of a political factional element to the squad selection itself, perhaps historically. I don't know if that's happened this time around, but I know it's not necessarily helped some past players and managers. Hopefully it is a calmer ship this time around, and if it is, they've got the talent.
Yeah, I think in terms of players to look out for Ghana, although that one of their biggest issues is the goalkeeping situation. They've had quite a few goalkeeping injuries, and who starts in goal for them is going to be a big massive talking point for them at the moment. But I think one of the players to definitely look out for is Mohamed Kudus. A lot of people will know him from Ajax, but he's come out and emerged as the man that probably everyone's going to be relying upon. 22 years old, he's been in incredible form for Ajax this season, and he's a really, on his day, he's a top player. And I think that he's the one maybe hope. I think that there's not much optimism around Ghana as much as there normally is, but he's the one player that maybe gives them that hope of kind of maybe they can do something. And I think their hopes of qualifying or even just beating Uruguay are going to come a lot down to Kudus's form.
Jonathan, is he likely to play a midfield or up front for them?
Yeah, I think he'll play as in a midfield role and sort of maybe as a sort of pushing forward and bursting through. You know, they still tend to rely on, you know, the IU brothers in forward positions, which you just mentioned, Halesley. So some people aren't necessarily happy with that. Jordan Ayew in particular, maybe there seems to be a lot of criticism around his starting role. But Inaki Williams is probably the one who might start up front.
Let's talk about South Korea then. And it's all, Jonathan, about the mask of Son Heung-min, isn't it?
It is indeed. And they are, you know, they're not a bad side, to be honest. I think they could fancy themselves to get out of this group. Like I said, I think the Uruguay game will be key there. And obviously the fitness of Son, I don't actually know if he's necessarily fit. I mean, do we have any updates on that?
I saw a picture of him in a mask.
He has been training with a mask, but I don't know how intensely he has been training.
Yeah, and obviously he missed their most recent friendly, I believe. I don't think he got any minutes. He definitely didn't start that. So that's the issue is, you know, obviously they've got a Portuguese coach, Paulo Bento, who that'll be an interesting one for him against Portugal.
Paulo Bento, your Portuguese management, used to manage Portugal and not very well as well. They were, you know, dumped out of the group stage in 2014. They lost to Germany and drew with the USA. So, you know, he's got that's not the big revenge game, I would suggest, in this group. But, you know, it's a tiny one. Beyond Son, Nick, you know, what have they got?
Yeah, they're not a one-man team. I mean, obviously, they've done well in recent years. They've got the boy at Napoli at the back who... That might be who Jonathan was referring to. Kim-in Jae. And, I mean, Napoli... We all know and have heard on this pod before, absolutely flying, and he's been a decent part of that, I think, at centre back. So that's some real pedigree. We know Hwang Hee-chan from Wolves, don't we? There's a lad at Freiburg in Germany doing very well. I think it's
Young Woo-hyung.
Woo-hyung, yeah, sorry. So they've got some players, you know, operating in and around the top levels. Hwang Hee-joo, I think, at Olympiacos scores goals. So it's not just Son, is what I'm saying. They're not a team that we really get to see much of over 90 minutes on television or even on streams over here. So it's a bit hard for me to sit here and tell you what everything they do well and badly. But all I'd say is, as with Senegal and Sadio Mane, it's a very big shame that Son is so seemingly touch and go for the tournament. But there are other options. And in a tournament, you don't know who else might step up. So I think they're definitely a team that's going a bit under the radar and a team that's maybe got a little bit more know-how than people are realising.
That's just quite refreshing in a way that there are teams that we don't, because of time differences and just the sheer amount of football, that we don't know everything about. That's the thrill of a World Cup, is that you don't come with everything. I'm not saying don't listen to these previews, obviously. They're very important. But, like, you know, some things actually you can just learn while you're watching the game. Anyway,
back when I started watching World Cups, you knew nothing about most of these teams, like absolutely nothing. There was no internet. There was no World Soccer. There was no 442 magazine. There were no podcasts. So it was like guys, aliens coming from outer space. And you just, yeah, it's really exciting when you don't know.
There were no experts like us informing the public lucidly and with great authority on the eve of a tournament, were there?
Wasn't it better when we didn't exist, is what we're trying to say. The only other thing I wanted to point out is obviously, we all knew they moved it from the summer to the winter because of the weather. But I just sort of saw, you know, Henry Winter videoing, like, going for a run around Doha, and John Cross tweeting the same thing. And Nicky, you're shaking as if, are you not going to tweet yourself jogging around Doha? But, like, it's hot. It's like 32 degrees at this time. I mean, I don't know what time it is there now. It's a bit later.
3 hours ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so what, 11:45. So I guess that it's not going to get much, much hotter than that. But still, that is... You know, Paul Scholes is not going to have a good tournament, everybody. It's too hot for him.
No, I think it's going to get cooler. I think by the end of next week, it gets to a chilly 28 or 29 degrees. And then maybe once we hit December, it plummets a bit. But yeah, it is hot. And you do wonder whether some teams or some styles of football are going to find that preferable, especially in the group stages. But then again, it's not like we've not had hot World Cups before. Russia was searing at some points, for example, and a lot of others I can think of. But it could well have an impact. But I will probably not be joining Crossy for his morning job. I will find other ways to exercise.
All right, then. That'll do for today. Thank you, Nick. Enjoy a safe trip and enjoy it over there.
Thank you. Speak soon, no doubt.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks very much.
Cheers, Baz.
Thanks.
This is going out tomorrow, I think, Barry, so I'll see you tonight in Hackney. But that has happened by the time people listen to this, but it'll be very nice to see you in person. That'll do for our previews. Part three is the final of our specials in the lead up to this World Cup. Today, we focus on the role and treatment of women in Qatar.
Erst 8 Stunden Arbeit, danach zum Training und jetzt sollst du noch was Richtiges kochen? Ja, das geht mit HelloFresh. Wähle einfach protein- und vitaminreiche Rezepte aus und erhalte genau die richtigen Zutaten in deiner HelloFresh-Box. So planst du deine Woche und Mahlzeiten easy und landest nicht immer nur bei Pizza und Pommes. Jetzt kannst du bis zu 100 sportliche Euro auf deine ersten 4 HelloFresh-Boxen sparen mit dem Code FSSPORT100.
Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly, our fourth and final special in the series. Today, we focus on women's rights. The constitution in Qatar says women are equal before the law. But is that really the case? What are lives really like for women there? How much does it differ for expats, migrant workers and the Qatari population? And how does it compare with the rights and experiences of women across the region? It's a conversation that's happening far less than other serious issues that we've already discussed on the pod. We felt it was really important to have it. We have a panel today. Rothna Begum is women's rights researcher for the Middle East and North Africa region for Human Rights Watch. Rothna, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Louise Donovan is a reporter for Fuller Project, focusing on gender issues and labour investigations. Hi, Louise.
Hiya.
And Football Weekly's guiding light and moral compass, Philippe Auclair, joins us. Hello, my friend.
Hello, Max. Hello, Louise. Hello, Rothna.
So a very sort of basic question to begin with. How do you feel about the fact the World Cup is in Qatar, Louise?
I think it's hard to ignore everything that has been coming out around workers' rights. You know, there's been a lot of allegations. There seems to be a lot of problems, you know, not just with women, but, you know, sort of with LGBTQI people. There's a lot of issues and I personally find it quite hard to ignore.
So when FIFA gave them the right to host it in 2022, which is 12 years later, they just didn't say anything about imposing labor rights conditions on them or human rights issues. And yet, even at that time, you know, I had been documenting abuses against migrant workers. I had cases of terrible kinds of prosecution of women for so-called love crimes, as well as women who had been confined in their homes by their fathers, and there was nowhere for them to turn to at the time either. So it was, you know, for some surprising, others quite shocking. But for me, the big issue was this is all going to happen with no conditions on improving the rights conditions for people in the country.
Rothna, how does the situation, and Louise, how does the situation in Qatar for women differ from the situation of women, say, in Saudi Arabia, where, you know, people know about the repression of, women activists? We had on the Football Weekly, we had Lina Al-Athloul, who told us about her sister Loujain and the absolute hell that she had to go through. Is the situation comparable in Qatar for women?
You know, I started working on Saudi Arabia a long time ago, but when I began doing research on the situation for women in Qatar, I knew that they had very similar rules or some similar situations, but I was actually quite surprised and taken aback at just how many rules existed on their lives and just how extensive the male guardianship rules were as well, and that some of it was comparable. And in some ways, they had become worse because we had actually achieved some progress in Saudi in recent years. So, for instance, in Qatar, what we found is that women in Qatar must obtain permission from their male guardians to marry, to study on government scholarships, work in many government jobs, travel abroad until certain ages, and to receive some forms of reproductive health care.
One of you mentioned love crimes there. Louise, what does that mean?
So this is the issue of the country's kind of penal code criminalizes sex outside of marriage. And so, you know, if a woman does decide to report sexual assault, police often tend to believe men. They often tend to not believe the women, say rights groups. You know, so instead of siding with, when men claim, then claim it was consensual, this can lead to the survivor being prosecuted. You know, and this has happened. There have been cases of this where, you know, women have been sentenced to lashings and to sort of 7 years in prison because they have reported their own sexual assault. The men say it's consensual, and then the women are the people. The women are at fault, essentially. And it is a deterrent. You know, it is a deterrent, say, rights groups. You know, women will be disinclined to report that stuff because of the high risks that, you know, could be played out if they do.
Of course. I mean, it's hard enough for women to report those kind of things anyway, right? In the UK, isn't it? And so to have that extra layer of like this falling back on you is, I can't imagine the torment that would be. I don't know, Rothen, if you've spoken to women who've been through that.
Yes, that's right. So I've documented cases of women who have essentially faced sexual violence and found themselves being prosecuted instead. One woman talked about how, and these are often, just to explain, with love, so-called love crimes, consensual sex, this disproportionately falls on women because of the fact that they're the ones who will be reporting sexual violence and can be accused, but also because pregnancy serves as evidence of the crime or the so-called crime. So it's women who are disproportionately impacted by this offense, but also women migrant domestic workers are the most impacted. The cases I documented of women involved a Filipino domestic worker who said that she had been raped by another fellow worker from a different house. He jumped inside into the garden, went into her little maid room and had raped her. She had called the police. The police, she was confined to the house. She actually had to climb out the window. The police asked her to climb out the window for her to give the report. And initially they took her report, found the guy. But at that point he said, yes, I had sex with her, but it was consensual. On that basis, they then began to interrogate her on believing that they had a relationship, and then went through her phone and found his number in her phone. And she said, well, the other domestic worker had also been using her phone, so maybe they knew each other, but she definitely did not know him. And then she was arrested. So she was held in a cell. She didn't know what was going on. 4 months later, she asked the prison guard, like, why am I being held? I reported the rape. And I'm in prison right now. What's going on? And she said, oh, well, you've been charged with a love crime. And it was only at that moment that she knew what was going on. And, you know, so we have cases of women who talk about reporting the crime of rape and finding themselves being prosecuted for the crime of consensual sex. And when we talk about the crime of consensual sex, we see how the authorities' understanding of consent is very broad. Simply knowing your offender is enough for the authorities to believe that you were in a relationship with them.
One very striking thing about Qatar is the really high proportion of women who actually are in secondary and education and in universities compared to men. And does that mean that they get same access to the workplace on one hand? And also, is there within those women who are very well educated, is there a desire and ambition to organize as women? Are there women groups, for example, in those universities?
So in Qatar, absolutely, there are far more female graduates than male graduates in the country. So women are really breaking barriers in the country. And really, we've really seen progress in the last 20 years where, you know, so many women are highly educated. But yet, their unemployment rate is double that of men. So they do face severe barriers when it comes to employment. And one of the issues I found was that women going into government jobs, so trying to get into the civil service, many of these government ministries were asking women for guardian permission before they hire them. Now, this isn't a law. There's no rule on this. And yet government ministries were insisting on this. Not all of them, but many of them.
The world's best players are coming to Qatar this year, inspiring boys and girls alike.
When we talk about football, we're talking about fair play and inclusion. So women as fans, women as supporters. And there are Qatar women who are big, big football fans, right? So it's not divorced from them at all. The issue we have is that women in Qatar face severe discrimination in law and in practice in a country that has not done a huge amount progressing for their rights. You know, one question asked earlier was, are there any women's groups in the country? Well, there are no women's rights groups. And that's because Qatar makes it really difficult for people to register associations or organizations because they ban anything that's deemed to be political. It's very difficult for women to also talk about women's rights online or in person. We've had women talk about how cybersecurity has summoned them for talking about women's rights online, where they're interrogated and then they have to sign pledges saying that they will stop talking about women's rights. And so we do see this issue where Qatar is going out of its way, proactively preventing a progressive realization of women's rights in the country, and at the same time emboldening people who are more conservative to harass and intimidate women into silence as well.
And I think that question of why should football fans care? I mean, I think if you're going to Qatar and you're going to be there, I mean, you're going to be meet. So I report on migrant women in the Gulf, and I've been reporting on migrant women in Qatar. And these are women. I was speaking to women in the hospitality sector, in the hotels. So if you're going to Qatar, you're going to probably be meeting these women. They're going to be cleaning your rooms. You know, they're going to be taking your food order, your dinner order, your drinks order. You know, you will be meeting these women. They're not just faceless kind of characters, you know, and there's been a huge spike in the number of workers working in the hospitality sector to cater for all these fans. You know, these women, they're vital. They're needed for the infrastructure of the World Cup. You know, they're a big part of making this tournament happen. And I will say through the interviews that the women that I've spoken to, you know, I've heard kind of a range of issues. They've worked in luxury hotels over the last couple of years. The thing that I heard again and again from the interviews speaking to these women is that at the end of the day, the guest is always right. You know, they always put the guest first. And I think that's just good information for people to have going over to Qatar, just to be aware that you are viewed as first, the staff in the hotel are viewed as second, and just, you know, have that information and be with it and know that you're going to meet these women face to face and the kind of conditions that they've said that they faced in the past.
Rothna, there is a fear amongst the LGBTQ+ community that sort of any sort of protests in Qatar or any sort of very visual support for that community will actually result in recriminations when we've all left Qatar and we're thinking about something completely different. I wonder if there is a similar feeling amongst women. It is an issue that is talked about much less, actually. You know, when you look at the headlines, it's, you know, migrant workers, mainly male. It is the LGBTQ+ community because of the laws there. I wonder what the feeling is amongst, well, for women in Qatar.
When I was doing this research on male guardianship on women, a lot of the women were worried about even speaking to me, in part because they were worried that it was actually going to make things worse, that if we reported on their situation, they may actually make it more regressive and more difficult for women. And that seems about outrageous because normally, you know, if you have an issue of human rights or women's rights issues, you're supposed to report on it to say, look, this is a problem and here's how we want to fix it. But for women, the thing that they had to contend with was it going to make their situation worse? And it's still an issue right now where women, you know, are wondering and contemplating, do I speak to the media about this or is it going to make it more difficult for me? And so, you know, women, there are very few women who are willing to go public. And if they are, they're going to have to think about how they do in an anonymous kind of way and in a safe kind of way. And that's a really, really hard thing to do. And some women have decided just not to do it altogether because they'd rather wait for the World Cup to be over and then think about how do we sort of push these things. Other women had wanted the World Cup attention to at least highlight their plight and see if there's ways that they could get some reforms before the World Cup happens. But we've seen so far that the authorities do not want to address the problem of women's rights. They simply deny that there is any problem at all, even though a lot of these policies are actually on their websites. It's there. It's very clear that they are doing this. And a lot of it are practices that they could easily tomorrow just stop altogether. And yet the authorities are just do not want to talk about women's rights issues. It's an issue that they are very much a red line about, at least in public. But we are hoping that even with whether or not the World Cup, when it happens and following it happening, that the authorities finally come to reckon with what they're doing, because they are an outlier right now. Within the region, they are one of the most regressive countries on women's rights. And when women have, and there's lots of women who have achieved much in the country, but that's of their own doing. They did it navigating these rules and trying to get their fathers on side and managed to make incredible progress. But they should not be forced into that situation. Right now, Qatar has incredibly discriminatory rules that is far worse than even its closest Gulf neighbors. And they should really repeal that to allow women to fully engage in society as well as in the economy.
Look, it's not the only socially conservative country in the world, Louise, and like how will rights of women improve? It has to come from within, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, speaking specifically to the work that I've done around women in the hospitality sector, I mean, you know, rights groups say that, you know, certain things need to be done. You know, assessments need to be conducted in order to understand who exactly their female migrant workforce are and what factors might make them susceptible to gender-based violence. You know, management need to be given training to spot signs of harassment, and they need to communicate effectively with this entire workforce, particularly subcontracted female employees who tend to be often at higher risk because there's less oversight of who they are and what they're doing. And hotel brands need to be clear on reporting processes, you know, next steps in terms of safeguarding, you know, how are they going to be protected, as well as psychosocial and medical support.
And one thing which we should really stress is that some of those companies are Western companies. They're not all Qatari companies. There are some very big hotel groups which have got European shareholders run by European managers. And these people should be named and shamed.
What do you think the experiences will be for, you know, female fans coming to the World Cup?
One of the big issues we have for any major sporting event around the world is that there is an increase in sexual violence. Like, simply having millions of people turning up means that the level of sexual violence just goes up. But the problem in Qatar is that the laws criminalize consensual sex, which means that women who report sexual violence can find themselves being prosecuted instead. Women who turn up as pregnant but unmarried can find it really difficult also to access sexual and reproductive health care unless they can prove that they are married. Now, we're calling on the authorities to lift these rules and ensure that women can actually report sexual violence without fearing prosecution and be able to access all forms of sexual and reproductive health care without needing to prove that they're married. Now, the authorities may do this. We're seeing reports now coming out saying that the authorities might have this happen during the course of the 5 weeks of the World Cup. So, but we need them to be public about this, because if they don't, then women are going to be deterred. They're going to fear actually reporting it to the police, or even just to go get emergency contraception or go to a health clinic to get testing and treatment, which is what they will most likely do in the event of facing such sexual violence. And the other thing is that the authorities need to keep that going forward. Just because the World Cup is over doesn't mean that sexual violence won't continue to happen. And that means that they need to get rid of these laws altogether and ensure full access to reproductive and sexual health care for all women in Qatar.
Rothna, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Same to you, Louise. Thank you. It's really important conversation. It's not one that I expected we were going to have, but I think it's really been really worthwhile. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Philippe, as always.
Thank you, Max.
When we reached out to the Qatari government with some of the allegations in this episode, a spokesperson told us that they were extremely disappointed by our decision to, in their words, deliberately exclude Qatari and Arab voices. They said that many of the allegations put forward are categorically false and paint an inaccurate picture of the reality in Qatar. They told us that women are vital to Qatari society, and they have continued to introduce and expand policies to ensure women play an active role in business, government, and society. They said more women in Qatar are enrolled in higher education than men, women have equal pay, and are entitled to the same training and promotion opportunities as their male counterparts in the government sector. And that Qatari women occupy prominent positions in government as ministers, ambassadors, and CEOs. In terms of freedoms, a government spokesperson told us that marriages in Qatar can only take place with the woman's consent, that Qatari women have been eligible to vote in elections for as long as men, that they are responsible for their own finances, and that they can drive without restriction from the age of 18. They also told us that Qatari law prioritizes the safety and well-being of all women, that assault is criminalized under the penal code, and access to justice is a guaranteed right for all through the Qatari court system. They also said that Qatar's constitution prohibits all forms of discrimination against women. And they told us the allegation that women have been sentenced to lashings or seven-year prison sentences because they've reported their own sexual assault is baseless and rejected in the strongest possible terms. A statement on behalf of the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy said that they were committed to delivering an inclusive and discrimination-free FIFA World Cup experience that is welcoming, safe, and accessible to all participants, attendees, and communities in Qatar and around the world. They said that everyone is welcome in Qatar, but we are a conservative country, and any public display of affection, regardless of orientation, is frowned upon. We simply ask for people to respect our culture. We also reached out to FIFA with specific allegations made here, but they chose not to respond directly. They told us previously that FIFA's position on inclusivity and the protection of human rights is unequivocal, and that Qatar, as a host country, is fully aware of its responsibility to adhere to FIFA's expectations and requirements on human rights, equality, and non-discrimination. This part was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer was Max Sanderson.